third ordination vow, for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. Of the four ordination vows, in a sense, that's the most obvious. Because if we know anything about Buddhism, it's to do with enlightenment. From a certain point of view, it's the most obvious of the four ordination vows. What is the Buddha's enlightenment, out of which the whole of Buddhism came? It's the one event in history which sort of is the root of everything we do, of the whole of Buddhism, of the whole of the Dharma. And also, ideally, our own practice should lead towards enlightenment. So, yeah, from this point of view, Buddhism is about enlightenment. At the same time, although it's so obvious, it's probably the one of the four ordination vows, or these four areas, which is most easily forgotten or neglected. I mean, just thinking about myself, of these four areas of being an order member, this is the one I spend least time thinking about. And I think I'm not alone in that. I find that interesting. Maybe it's to do with... So I think we often forget about enlightenment when we practice Buddhism. Maybe there's a common pattern there that when one gets involved in Buddhism, enlightenment is really interesting. Yeah, sort of, how far is it away, when will I reach it, and so on. So at the beginning of one's practice of Buddhism, it becomes really interesting, sort of gaining enlightenment. After a few years, I think one notices, one doesn't get anywhere near it, and yeah, one just sort of forgets about it. Yeah, it's certainly my experience, I sort of forgot about it in a way. Yeah. That in the end, what we're doing is about enlightenment. It seems as a goal too far away and maybe therefore irrelevant for us. But at the same time, this is what Buddhism is about. In order to make spiritual progress, we need sort of two things. I think one of Bhante's Hindu teachers said that. That sort of we need a clear goal and a clear idea of how to get there. So to make spiritual progress, this is what we need. We have a clear idea where we're, what we're aiming at and how to get there. So at least, without at least some awareness of enlightenment and what it is, most of our practice is just sort of aimless. I think it's what we often do. We practice in a kind of aimless way, sort of doing all the good things. But speaking for myself, there's not a great deal of plan behind it. Just do the things one does. Yeah. But often not with much clarity of what I'm aiming at. So yes, it's important to be aware of enlightenment as one's goal or as one's orientation. So what is enlightenment? So I'm going to talk now a bit about sort of, the nature of enlightenment, what enlightenment consists in. So before I do that, I have to make one thing clear, which I think should be clear, but just mentioned anyway. When we talk about enlightenment, we talk about enlightenment in Buddhism, not in other systems or religions. I think there can be a bit of confusion about that. There can even be the view that this thing called enlightenment above all the religions, and they also lead to it, but really one should go beyond all this. I don't think it is like that. Yeah? Just because different traditions use the same term doesn't mean that they mean the same thing. It's an obvious point in a way, but it's something that gets forgotten. So we're talking about enlightenment in Buddhism, not enlightenment in Hinduism, Vedanta, and all the rest of it. So the first thing to say about enlightenment is it's beyond us. We can't understand it. Bhante goes into that in his in the survey, in the first chapter of the survey, in the section on ineffable nirvana. We just cannot understand the nature of enlightenment, of nirvana, and we cannot understand the nature of the Buddha. Truth, nirvana, enlightenment is sort of beyond concepts, beyond our faculty. It's not just we lack the information, our mind isn't sort of constructed the way that we can understand it. Yeah? Enlightenment or nirvana transcends our categories of thinking. Yeah. So the first thing to say about enlightenment, we don't know what it is. It's sort of completely beyond ourselves. And also, connected to that, we cannot understand the nature of the Buddha. Yeah. Even the Buddha is completely beyond us. The nature of the Buddha is completely beyond us. This comes out very often in the Pali Canon, so for the Buddha's question of what would happen to him after death, or to anybody who's enlightened. Yeah? And the categories of existing or non-existing, or both or neither, are just wrong. But we cannot think, we cannot but think in terms of he exists or he doesn't exist. Yeah? There's no other way for us of thinking that. But at the same time, they're wrong. Yeah? They don't describe what the enlightened person is. So enlightenment, nirvana, is completely beyond us. Our samsaric mind cannot comprehend it. Yeah. We don't have the right faculties to understand it. They're sort of missing. Now, there's a danger in that, and that is sort of hiding behind confusion. Yeah, I think sort of it's very easy to take the fact that enlightenment is sort of incomprehensible and hide behind that. Yeah. Or become very clever about it. Yeah. Or, I cannot resist one of my quotes, my favorite quote from the Pali Canon here. It's from the Sandaka Sutta. For those who look for references, middle-length sayings, Majjhima Nikaya 76. Ananda talks about different kinds of teachings and teachers. And here he talks about teachings or teachers who teach a spiritual life which doesn't offer any consolation, any sort of security. So the quote is, "Again, Sandaka, here a certain teacher is dull and confused. Because he is dull and confused, when he is asked such and such a question, he engages in verbal wriggling, in eel wriggling. I don't say it is like this, and I don't say it is like that, and I don't say it is otherwise, and I don't say it is not so, and I don't say it is not so." Now, this sounds deceptively profound, but it's just confusion. I think if I say this with the rites of charisma, I'm sure I would get a following. And write books about it, so, run workshops. But it's just based on dullness and confusion. Yeah? So just because something is confusing doesn't mean it's profound. I think it's a quite important message in here. So there's a danger of sort of hiding in this sort of cloud of uncertainty and making it sound profound. And this can happen if we just concentrate on the fact that enlightenment is completely beyond us. I think what we have to do with the fact that enlightenment is beyond us, the nature of the Buddha is beyond us, we have to really grapple with it and understand why it is beyond us. I think that's the whole point for me about the whole perfection of wisdom literature. Yeah? Just getting sort of intellectually amused by paradoxes doesn't do much. Yeah? Other than amusing us intellectually. But what we have to do, we have to understand why they are a paradox and really sort of go into the problem. So we shouldn't forget that enlightenment is beyond us. The whole of the Dharma, where it comes from, is a completely different dimension from our own. So what the Buddha taught, what Buddhism teaches, in the end, comes from a completely different dimension. It's not another worldly philosophy. So it is beyond us, okay? But at the same time, the Buddha did say a few things about the nature of enlightenment, so that we sort of got something to work with. So there's different ways in which enlightenment is described. I'm not going to mention all of them here, just the ones which I think are probably most important. So maybe the safest way of describing enlightenment is in terms of what it is not, negative description. Yeah. Enlightenment, nirvana, is not craving, hatred, and delusion. That's maybe the safest way of describing enlightenment. Because there's no danger that we think we know what we're talking about. Okay. Yeah, so nirvana is freedom from craving, hatred, and delusion. Complete freedom from craving, hatred, and delusion. I think you could say the delusion, that's of ignorance, is basically the belief I exist, I am. And craving and hatred is looking after that me. that I am. Craving and hatred are strong terms, but I think they go into very subtle areas. And maybe also the subtle areas we need to look at. Yeah? So I would say hatred and craving are a way of looking after ourselves, you know, worrying about ourselves. Yeah? And as long as we do that, we're not enlightened. Yeah? As long as we function in a self-centered way, we are not moving towards enlightenment, we're not enlightened. For me, it's sort of connected with the sort of being anxious about oneself or worrying about myself. Yeah? It's not just living my life, but at the same time, this commentary going on, which sort of refers everything which happens to me. Yeah? Am I successful? Am I popular? Unpopular? All that. It's all about me. Yeah? And that's craving, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, in the more subtle level. So enlightenment is a complete absence of this. And maybe that's the most truthful thing, the most exact thing we can say about enlightenment from our point of view. Yeah, because we all know what craving, hatred, delusion is. So we sort of do it all the time. So just sort of the absence of this, and you have enlightenment. The complete absence of this. So it's quite safe to sort of describe enlightenment in these terms. But there's a problem with this description, which I think Bhante points out a lot in many of his writings. They're purely negative terms. And just having an idea of the goal in terms of what it is not, well, it can lead to a dry sense of the idea. It's not very interesting. It tends towards nihilism, and it may not move us very much. I mean, very few people are inspired by negative descriptions of the goal. I mean, actually, I can be inspired by it, but I'm aware not many people can be inspired by it. So the danger of this, of only this negative description of nirvana, is it all gets a bit dry and unattractive. And we have to be moved. I mean, the whole thing about Buddhism is that if we do something, yeah? So we have to be motivated to do something. And that's better done in positive descriptions. So then we have positive descriptions of the goal, of nirvana, of enlightenment. So we have the qualities of the enlightened one, which are often described as these innumerable qualities. It's in one of the puchas, I think it's the confession pucha, the qualities of a single Buddha cannot be told. Yeah. So from this point of view, the Buddha has innumerable qualities beyond what we can imagine. But the most important list is those of wisdom, compassion and love, energy, equanimity, and so on. So there's certain qualities which we can associate with enlightenment. In a sense, these positive qualities are what the enlightened one looks like to us. And so we would exhibit wisdom, compassion, energy, equanimity, love, and so on. So these are the positive descriptions. And that gives us something to sort of strive towards. I think we all had moments of wisdom, compassion, and so on, so we can relate to it. Yeah? So sort of in giving positive descriptions of enlightenment qualities, which we know, at least to some extent, we can relate to enlightenment. By the way, another of the positive ones is ethical behavior. That's another very important description of the enlightened one. The enlightened one is incapable of performing certain unethical acts. So at enlightened one, and one is not beyond good and evil. Yeah. One cannot act unethically. So there's a text in which the Buddha says the arahant, the enlightened one, is incapable of killing, stealing, sexual intercourse, lying, and so on. Yeah. You just can't do it. So another positive description. So this is something we can sort of work towards. Yeah, something which can inspire us and something we can relate to. But again, this approach on its own level has its advantages and its limitations. The limitation is we think we know what we're talking about. The advantage is we can be moved by it. Yeah, so something to strive towards. Some qualities to develop. The problem is, because we have got some idea what metta is, because we're doing the metta bhavana, we think we know what full-blown metta is. Yeah. Or because we have some clear moments, we think we know what wisdom is. So there's a danger that we sort of think we know what we're talking about when we talk about wisdom and compassion. Yeah, so all these descriptions have their sort of strengths and weaknesses, or they all have their purpose. And therefore it's useful to have different approaches to enlightenment, to nirvana. Maybe one can say that if we only concentrate on the positive descriptions and forget about the negative ones, we probably tend to neglect things like giving up, renunciation. Yeah? And we're probably more in danger of creating a Buddhist samsara rather than nirvana. Mm-hmm. There's a danger if we neglect the negative formulations. We just talk about the positive ones. So we want to create a better world for us. So there's a certain value in the negative descriptions. I mean, they've sort of got a bad press in the FWBO, but they do have their value. There's another way of looking at enlightenment. This is, again, something one can easily forget. Enlightenment doesn't exist in itself. I mean, there is no such thing as enlightenment or nirvana. There's no nirvana. There's only people or beings who have attained nirvana. So a way of approaching looking at enlightenment is looking at enlightened beings. So one of those obvious things one tends to forget. I think one can get into the sort of debates about what enlightenment is and just forget about looking at people who are said to have reached it. We can or get all a bit theoretical. So another way of looking at enlightenment is, well, look at the people who've done it. So first of all, the Buddha. Yeah. Read his life story, especially from the Pali scriptures. And what I found when I read more of the Pali canon and had a closer look at the Buddha there, I've got a strong sense of a person being there, rather than just a sort of screen to project everything noble and good onto. Yeah. So I got a certain sense when I read the Pali canon more that there's somebody there. It's like a person you meet, not just some sort of abstract good being. Yeah. There's a certain somebody there. Even more so if we look at the disciples of the Buddha, I mean the arahants, the enlightened disciples of the Buddha. I think it's really useful and helpful just to look at their lives and look as of how they live. Because then you've got an idea of how enlightened beings live their lives. And also, these arahants, they're a bit of more, they're not as completely perfect as the Buddha. So he's a bit closer to us. If you look at sort of Buddhist role models, modeling ourselves on the Buddha is maybe a bit much and a bit abstract. But we can look at sort of enlightened disciples of the Buddha. Yeah. And see they had personal one-sidedness. There were certain people, they had certain strengths and weaknesses and so on. Yeah. So I think it's really valuable to look at to look at the Pali Canon in terms of looking at the people. I think one can read the Pali Canon looking for teachings. But I think it's maybe even more important or valuable to look at the Pali Canon looking at sort of how people live their lives. It's really fascinating, actually. So yesterday we had the example of the Anuruddhas. So we have an example of enlightened people organize a community, for example. So that's the fourth way of looking at enlightenment. It's personified. Enlightenment doesn't exist in the abstract. Yeah? It only exists in people. Okay, so for a brief description of enlightenment. So it's important to remember, ultimately, we don't have the capacity to understand what enlightenment is. Nirvana is completely beyond us. At the same time, from our point of view, we must have some idea of our goal, which is described negatively or positively, and it's also embodied in persons. So now the sort of important point, what about us in all this? Because enlightenment or nirvana is not just something sort of interesting one can have in one's life. It's actually at ordination what we commit ourselves to attaining. Again, we often forget that we're doing this. Yeah, that at ordination, we commit ourselves to the highest ideal possible in humanity, in the universe. I think it's sort of worth reflecting on that before and after you got ordained. Before, it's not too late to change. Afterwards, you see what you've done. I think it's sort of quite remarkable what we do in a way. Yeah? So we commit ourselves to the highest possible human idea or ideal in the universe. So how can we relate to enlightenment? Or how can we relate to this third ordination vow or verse of acceptance? Just a few thoughts on that. This ordination vow reminds us of the fact that what we're doing is in the end about the transcendental. I think with the other three vows, there can be a danger of forgetting that. Yeah. So with the first two ones, of loyalty to one's teachers and harmony with friends and brethren, there can be a danger of thinking of, you know what it's all about, and or of getting to order politics, yes, of who's getting on with whom, so things. Yeah. With the fourth one, about the bodhisattva ideal, there's a danger of forgetting in the end it's about enlightenment, about the transcendental, not just about doing good. So there can be a danger with the other three ones that sort of one forgets, one can easily forget the transcendental context in which it all happens. So this third one should be a reminder of that. It should remind us that we're not interested so much in creating Buddhism, but creating the Dharma, yeah? Not creating a Buddhist samsara. And also our practice of Buddhism shouldn't be about coping with the world. It shouldn't enable us to deal with the world in a better way. I mean, if it does that, good. But that's not really why we're doing it. But he says something interesting about that somewhere. I can't remember where he says it. About being so psychologically straightforward or not straightforward. And what he says, I just have to find the quote. Something like, people who are very sort of healthy in a human, worldly way may find their spiritual life more difficult than people who are a bit weird, is the term, yeah? Because they sort of keep striving. Yeah? So just because you're in a worldly way a bit sort of incapable, unusual, or eccentric, may be a good thing. So our practice of Buddhism should not be about sorting us out in a sort of worldly way. I mean, if it does that, to some extent, it's good. And in this third ordination vow, this verse, reminds us of the fact that we've got something to strive towards. We've got a goal. We've got an aim. And it's very interesting looking at that, because going back to the descriptions of enlightenment, on the one hand, it's completely alien to us. If you look at the descriptions, we cannot comprehend it. At the same time, you see people doing it. I find it a very interesting tension almost, a very interesting dynamic. Yeah. So if you read this Pali scripture, there's people attaining enlightenment all the time. But then you've got these descriptions which are completely beyond us. It's an interesting dynamic, or interesting, almost dilemma to work with. So we've got this ideal, which is completely alien to us, completely different. But at the same time, it's possible to achieve it, because people have done it. So that creates interesting problems. I think a way to approach this, what one could do, or should, what we should do, really, when we live out a third ordination vow, is ideally we should match our actions against the ideal of enlightenment. What we really ideally would be doing is being aware of the ideal of enlightenment, ideally all of the time. And whenever we are about to do something, or think something, or say something, just check, how does it fit with our ideal of enlightenment? Yeah. In body, speech, and mind. Just a few words on how that would work in mind. In meditation, for example, Whenever we indulge in a meditation hindrance, we move away from enlightenment, directly away from it. So when you find yourself in a hindrance, and you just sort of indulge in it, or don't care much about it, it doesn't matter, yeah, you move away from enlightenment. Whenever we deal with the hindrances and fight them, we move towards enlightenment. So it's one very sort of immediate way of working on that. Also, outside meditation, we can sort of ask ourselves, what do we think about, worry about, get upset about, get worked up about? And then think, how does that fit in with my ideal of enlightenment? Is this sort of worth it? Is this sort of, I've said I want to gain enlightenment, the highest ideal, and here I get worked up about something trivial. So we can match our actions, our mental states, our mental habits, mainly the mental habits, I think, against this ideal of enlightenment. Am I weakening craving, hatred, delusion, or am I strengthening craving, hatred, delusion? And doing this creates this horrible problem that we fail. So we create this problem or tension between what we are and what we sort of like to be. And, which leads to stress or a sense, which can lead to stress, to a sense of failure and so on. Can lead to a sense of not being good enough. Yeah. And then we all think we should be relaxing much more and so on. Now, Bhante makes a point in the second set of 15 points, don't accept yourself. And I think if we really take on the goal of enlightenment, we won't accept ourselves as we are now. So yes, we have this sort of problem, and we shouldn't shy away from that. So in committing ourselves to the Dharma, to enlightenment, we have, in a sense, we create this tension between what we are and what we sort of think we should be, or our idea, what we would want to become. The idea between what we are and what we would want to become. And I think here it's important not to find an easy solution for that problem, or more to live creatively. So easy solutions would be giving up and despair. I'm not good enough. And it's one very easy solution for the problem of not living up to one's idea. Getting into low self-esteem or modesty, false modesty. This is, according to Gampopa, laziness. It's one of the forms of laziness, it's low self-esteem. So I think that's one way of not dealing with it in a creative way, just of telling yourself that you're a bad person and not good enough. And in a way, it's an easy way out. The other, not very creative way of dealing with it, is getting the ideal down, of limiting the ideal. Maybe the Buddha was just an ordinary person. Or maybe enlightenment consists in just ordinary going through one's life. And then we all know this enlightened ordinary person who just goes through their life and we think they're enlightened. The romantic ideas of simple enlightened beings who just don't seem to have problems. But it's not like that. So, another wrong way or uncreative way of dealing with it just to sort of pull the ideal down. Or denying the ideal altogether. Just pretending there isn't a problem. Another denying. Yeah. Samsara and Nirvana are one. One should go beyond that dualism. I think that's just a cheap way of getting out the problem. Yeah. Just deny there isn't one. And you can use Buddhist teachings for that. It's a danger. Go beyond this dualism of good and bad and so on. There's such an interesting quote I found some years ago. It stuck with me. It's from, I don't know who, one of these meditation teachers in the sort of Theravada Thai tradition. I don't know which one it was. He said something like, people who believe that samsara and nirvana are one have never really meditated. I think what he's saying is they've never really looked at their own minds. Because if you really look at your own mind, you notice there's a difference between the worldly mind and the enlightened mind. Yeah? So I found that a really interesting quote. People who believe that nirvana, enlightenment, and non-enlightenment are really one, have never really looked at their minds. They've never really meditated. don't quite know where the quote is, so I have to find it again. It's quite interesting. There's another way of dealing with this problem, which is a bit, I think it's what we probably do most of the time. It's fear of being extreme, or qualifying what we're saying. I noticed this when I prepared this talk, when I said, well, ideally, all of the time, we should match our actions against enlightenment. I was sort of tempted to sort of put in, yeah, but don't be too tight about it and be relaxing. Yeah. And I was tempted to qualify what I said, and so what I was about to say. I said, no, don't. Maybe we should be more extreme. Maybe our fear of sort of going to these extremes is what holds us back to some extent. Yeah. Maybe there's a sort of, I think there's this horrible fear of willfulness. Yeah, I think it's sort of, maybe that can hold us back to quite a big extent. Yeah, because there's this horrible fear of being willful, yeah, and being sort of narrow and all the rest of it, not striving because you harm yourself and all the rest of it. I think that fear can hold us back. So maybe we should be a bit more adventurous in our practice and not be afraid of going to extremes. Something to discuss for the groups. So maybe, I say maybe on purpose here, I'm not giving any dogmas here. Maybe we need more naive, one-sided enthusiasm in our spiritual life. Yeah. Not always have to solve the safety belt, you know, safety escape there. We can approach it. I think one way of approaching this is from a sense of positive pride. I think it's one way of approaching this issue of having high ideas. And it's a very big thing in Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, the cult of Buddha pride. It's a sense of, given ourselves the highest ideal possible, and so we should be too good for certain things. So we can, when we get into sort of negative mental states, sort of moaning and this sort of thing, we can ask ourselves, is what I get worked up about worthy of somebody striving for enlightenment? Yeah. We can develop this positive pride. Yeah. So somebody who's sort of got such a high ideal as me shouldn't get worked up about sort of something minor than that. A very interesting reminder of that when, well, I guess an example which can happen in life, when I ordered a book on Amazon and it didn't come. And I noticed this sort of, really sort of after a long time I wrote to them, and it was a book on the Bodhisattva-avatara. It was really good, so I thought, well, I'm not going to get impatient. It would be ridiculous getting impatient about a book on the Bodhisattva-avatara. But I noticed this sort of the tension there, so can be sort of upset about it and stupid people. No, hang on. You can't order a book on the Bodhisattva-avatara and they get angry with the people sending it. Yeah. So you can come from a sense of, it was a sense of positive pride. Yeah. So I got the book in the end. Yeah, so one way of approaching this problem of not living up to one's ideals, from a sense of positive pride. Shantideva goes into that quite a lot of, and now I must live up to my birth, and by my actions must place no stain upon the spotless family, and so on. So this is often the family pride of being born in the family of the Buddhas. Okay, so these were my main points on this, on the third ordination vow. So just to conclude, a few points. Maybe the main issues to do with this vow is it reminds us what we are about. Yeah, we should not forget that we committed ourselves to nothing less than the attainment of complete enlightenment. You sort of keep that in mind in our practice. This goal is this is something beyond our understanding. Yeah. So we committed ourselves, we should not forget that we committed ourselves to this really high ideal, which is really beyond our understanding. But for practical purposes, it's clearly defined. And as I said, it's really important to look at this very clear definitions of enlightenment and not hide behind this sort of cloud of confusion and mysticism. Others have attained it. Shouldn't forget that. Others have done it. And they had a human mind just that we had. They didn't start out completely different than we. So we've got the raw material, we've got a human mind. And we have to work creatively with this problem or in this tension between our ideal and how we are now. Thank you.